What they did there is they put an APB out on me, and I was wanted back here in California. So they gave me a plane ride back. I don't ever know what happened to my borrowed car, but they brought me back by plane to Oakland, which was an election year, and I was sent to Old Tehachapi. If I had, God has always been so good to me. I had 5 to 20 facing me. It seems like somebody had stolen a check. And remember I told you about my bank account was for $800 and some. I remember there was 13 cents on the end of it. And I took them to my bank and countersigned it. Now, I didn't know it was stolen. It was just some sucker I'd met in the bar. You know? And he was going to have over $800 to spend, and he was going to spend it on me if I had my way. So naturally, I was going to help him cash the check. Well, by the time they got me back, the FBI had dropped all charges. The check had been paid off by the insurance company. Everything had been cleared up. Everything. So they asked me, the man's name was Fox, and I'm half loaded the first time they take me in, and they said, do you know this, whatever his first name was, Fox? And I looked at the judge and I said, you could be him for all I know. So they locked me back up and they made me do some 5 days for default defendant, you know. So I did a lot of 5 days for default defendant, and then they took me back in, and they gave me this lump sum of time as an accessory. Well, I get up to Tehachapi, and we had a beautiful lady there head of that jail, Mrs. Hirschholt. And in those days, you used to have to practically go in solitary confinement for your first 30 days if you were going to do any long time. And so I went into solitary, and I really got sick. Because normally when I went into jail or a place like that, they asked me what I do, and I say, I cook. You know, because we used to make our own bread, and we had raisins and apricots and potato peelings and yeast. You know, that made good stuff on the back of the stove. But I wasn't getting it because I was locked away and I was sick. Well, she went through my C-file, and she called me in, and she said, was this your defense? And I said, yeah. She said, you had no attorney? And I said, no. The judge asked me if I was guilty. I said, I don't know. I could be, and I couldn't be. I don't know. And so they went ahead and railroaded me. And that lady called her secretary and wrote an appeal for me, and I was out in 7 months. She was one beautiful lady. After she left Tehachapi, she went to San Luis Obispo, and she worked with women who had come out of the penitentiary because she recognized, I found out later, the alcoholism in us.
Was that a halfway house or something like that?
No.
She just
kept in contact and worked with releasees. Back in those days, you know, there wasn't that many halfway houses. There wasn't places for people to go when they got out. She just knew, found a way to find out when who was getting released in her area. And she would let them know that she was available if they had any problems.
She was non-alcoholic.
She was a non-alcoholic. But she was one beautiful lady.
Yeah, well, let's go back to... We're going to talk about Lincoln Heights or something. We got sidetracked with Wino Joe and the bridge. I just wanted to get that on tape. But tell me about your involvement. And you know, we talked about the service.
Yeah.
Now, tell me about your involvement with H&I there. And you went to Bakersfield about 2 or 3 years after you got sober.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yes. There still was no H&I.
Okay. Okay, so now you've gone to Bakersfield.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
See, H&I didn't really come into being till after the Traditions came in.
In 55?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
We we're still writing the pink book in 61 and 62.
The H&I manual?
Yeah.
The pink one?
We got our pink can in the 70s. For a while, we were going all the northern area. There were perhaps about 60 members in H&I.
Northern area, what area would that be? Would that be from Bakersfield north?
No. No, from, Bakersfield is not in this area.
No, it's Southern California.
Southern Cal. We were just the northern area.
Oh, northern part of the southern area, okay.
Yeah. So we went into places like, Folsom, Soledad. We'd go down as far as Soledad. We'd go down as far as Atascadero. San Quentin. Napa. We did not go in anywhere where people could be released for meetings, which is what they're doing now. That
if they could get out and go to meetings, you wouldn't go there.
We shouldn't have to go there. It starts off that we are there for the people who are confined. Carry the message to the people who are confined. And these people who can get picked up by some expensive program and taken to meetings, let them go, you know. We have too much to do on our own, too many commitments. When I came here, there was no H&I in this area.
With Vacaville out here?
It had been here. This area got kicked out of Vacaville for interfering with the rules and regulations there. We have to be very careful to go along with the facility we're in.
That's part of your pink book.
We have to remember that we are invited guests. And we have to be very careful. It's a very narrow line, like a gray area, you know. And usually, when I go into a facility, I ask them, do you know what the Hospital and Institution Committee is? About 50% of them who are fairly new will shake their heads no, and I say, all right. As of necessity, we are a committee of alcoholics who have recovered in Alcoholics Anonymous. We do not, and I repeat, do not represent Alcoholics Anonymous. We are people who are 12-stepping you. We are here to tell you how we got sober. We're not here to tell you how we got in places like this, because it's evident you got in here all right by yourself. We're not here to tell you how much we drank, because evidently you know how much you drank or you wouldn't get a pass to get here. You know, I am very careful when I go in to keep Alcoholics Anonymous out of it. Because if anything happens in one of those meetings, I love you, I'm going to have to use that. Okay. Was going in before H&I was.
Before it became organized.
Yeah. And then I got involved in the Clinton Duffy Foundation.
San Quentin.
You haven't heard about that?
San Quentin.
Yeah. Well, no, it was a foundation to stop executions and I don't know. It was a mess. It went by the wayside. And while I was in that, I met old Bill Smith. We went to Stockton for a meeting, and Bill was there. And Bill started stomping. He and Clint didn't get along at all. And Clint made a couple of remarks that put AA down. And I went to dinner with Bill Smith that night, and I became an ardent admirer of the people who went into institutions under sort of an organized committee. And it was, according to traditions, that we have a right to form these committees and keep them outside of AA, to not be affiliated with AA in any way. And that's what we do. California does not get involved in New York AA at all. We fight very hard not to. A lot of people don't understand it, that a lot of us are here just to protect Alcoholics Anonymous. We will not affiliate with New York. We will stay a committee. And I think we'd better back up about going into all these paid facilities and things. It's like our friend Will says, we are too friendly with our friends. Just too friendly. And I think that these facilities, or the parasites as I call them, because they're proselyting our illnesses and all are getting ill. I had a daughter who was dying from drugs and alcohol. I know people who are running some of the places, and they wouldn't let her in unless I had $300. Today my daughter is dead. But that chance was denied her. It was a $10,000 program, and she had to have $300 up front, and I didn't have it. So on her 20th birthday, she committed suicide. Yeah, she had no place to go.
That was last year?
Last February. Last February. So you see, I love the young people, and I think we've got to reach out to them. But we've got to teach them to stick with the winners. Young people's groups aren't getting it. I do not believe in special purpose groups either. When I came into this program, it was men and women and young and old, and black, and white, and red, and oriental, Spanish, you know. If you couldn't speak English, you learn how. If you couldn't read, you learn how. We were all together helping each other get well. And these special purpose meetings, I do not go to. They've got them for gays in Sacramento. Well, that is a lifestyle problem. That's not an alcoholic problem. I had a lot of lifestyle problems because of my alcoholism. But I say, you know, if you want to be gay, be the best you know how. But don't bring it into AA. We're there for one reason, and that's alcoholism. We're not there for the square junkie or the addict. You know what a square junkie is, don't you?
No, what's that?
Well, a square junkie is a little old lady or a little old man or a little old anybody that's got five or six doctors on the hook. And they go from one to the other, and they get 30 days or 90 days supply of this or that or that. It never lasts that long. But they have this reservoir of doctors and drugstores. And they're square junkies.
I just hadn't heard the term before.
Now, a garbage pail junkie is somebody who will drop anything that anybody's got. An addict is somebody who shoots it in their veins. And when people sit around and saying, I'm an addict alcoholic, 90% of them haven't got the guts to shoot in their veins. And I never say I'm an addict alcoholic, but do you see them?
Mm-hmm. Well then, okay, so this little committee got going, but to be separate from AA,
mm-hmm.
and not affiliated with New York, now, your involvement in this started with, of course, Lincoln Heights.
Yeah. But it wasn't the committee then.
It wasn't a committee. It was just the groups.
Bunch of AAs going in.
The groups. And then ultimately they decided on a committee. And then you moved to Bakersfield.
It wasn't a committee yet.
It still wasn't a committee. And
it wasn't until I moved up to the ranch.
The one in Dublin?
Yeah. So I moved, then we became a committee.
Okay, that's when Bill Smith and Clinton Duffy and that thing got going.
Yeah.
And that was in about what year?
Late 60s.
Late 60s? Mm-hmm. Tell me some of the places that you've gone now in working with H&I. I know that they've got their own archives and so forth.
I've gone into Napa State Hospital. I've gone into Tehachapi. I've gone, you know, now I like going into Tehachapi. I can have the pick of the litter now. It's all men. I've gone into, I am one of the few women who have gone into Folsom. I go in for their anniversary party. It's a max security, and at Folsom, they don't like women in there, so only men go in there. I've gone into county jails, both in Sacramento County, Yolo County, Napa County, Solano County. I've gone into juvenile halls in all those counties. I've gone into mental wards, down to Stockton, into Napa, into Atascadero. I go in anywhere they'll open a door. Anywhere they'll open a door, I'm there. Even now, if I were to receive a call from the program director at Atascadero, and we don't handle it in this area, it's not one of our places to go in. It's for the Southern California. But if the lady who is one of my babies that runs that program down there were to call me and say, Vivian, will you come down and speak? I would go if I was physically able. I would go.
Okay, well then, what we have is you have a Northern California H&I committee and Southern California. And you kind of have a line there that says, okay.
It comes up as far as San Luis Obispo.
And it kind of comes east-west across the state? Okay, and then, then you moved from Bakersfield to Dublin.
To Dublin.
And is that where your husband was killed?
That's where he was killed.
And your son?
And my son.
Now, how did you get to Sacramento?
I just moved there.
I mean, was
I left the Bay Area and moved back to Sacramento.
Oh, had you been in Sacramento previously?
For a little while, but not long. We were just looking at business opportunities there.
And was this another marriage that caused you to move back?
No.
How did the name become Hinton?
I met my second husband in a meeting in San Francisco where I was speaking. He was from Colorado, had 2 years sobriety, supposedly. A year later, we were married. He came to Sacramento to see me a lot. His mother lived there. We were married, and out of that marriage, I got 6 months of sobriety. He was a periodic alcoholic. That's the worst. And a traveling salesman.
What a setup.
So I could tell you what trip he wasn't coming home from. He would leave the house absolutely sober, but there was something there. Everything would be all right, but I knew somewhere along the line that his friend Jack Daniels would creep in for 1 or 2 days, and then it would be gallons of wine, not on a back road, down on Skid Row, in jail, the whole Marianne for 3 or 4 weeks, 5 weeks, and then he would come home to get well. I would not let him drink at home after the baby was born.
The young
my
lady
daughter. She had a bad thing to draw to, you know. An alcoholic mother and an alcoholic father. And I believe that somewhere in our genes is our alcoholism. That we can trace our alcoholism back to something in our family. And I have another tape that I'll give you if I can find it before you go. That Dr. Lackner from Sacramento. Have you ever heard him talk?
No, I haven't.
Well, I want you to. He's a non-alcoholic doctor, and he is terrific. He is terrific. He loves the alcoholic. All of his patients in Sacramento are alcoholic.
How did that marriage end? Or did it?
My husband ran away with a woman. His mother.
He ran away with his mother.
She was his enabler. She would never do anything for the little girl and I while he was gone. But all he had to do was call her up and say, I want to get cleaned up and go home. And she'd send him any amount of money. And then he would be gone for another couple weeks, you know. But when he got home, she'd do anything for him. And it got to where when he was real sick, or if he was still drinking, I would tell him, all right, go to a motel or go to your mother's.
Till you're through.
You can come home and get well, but you can't drink at home. I will not have it around the baby. Maybe I should have exposed her to more of it, but I didn't. You know. He was two people. He was a beautiful, clean, wonderful man. He was blonde, very light-skinned, but when he drank, he was the kind of a salesman that carried two suits in his car. So if he perspired, he would change suits before he went into a client. He was immaculate, head to toe. When he came home, he had cotton in his eyes, on the corner of his lips, wine on his chin and his lips. His clothes would be stiff. And I've seen him stand up and try to hang his clothes. And we had one of these on the back of the chair things, you know, stand there and weave. Try to get that crease that wouldn't come back in. Try to get it in, you know.
Well, how did he pass away?
Or? No, I don't know where he is.
You don't know where he is. So you raised your daughter on your own?
Since she was eight years old.
Yeah, I'm not trying to be personal.
No, since she was 8 years old.
Just to bring the story up chronologically.
From the time she was 8 years old, she was my baby.
And you worked and supported her?
Yeah. I was an apartment house manager in Sacramento for a long while. And then things were getting bad in Sacramento, and I moved out of Sacramento. And I moved up to a place called Oric. Do you know where Oric is? Well, do you know where Central Point is?
You're still getting me, no.
Do you know where Eureka is?
Yeah, now we're...
All right, you go 51 miles north of Eureka. There is a little town there called Klamath. It has gold bears on the river, on the bridge. Have you ever seen those?
No.
Well,
I have not been up that far.
You've missed a beautiful ride.
Right on the coast.
Mm-hmm. It's the coast and the redwoods and everything. Well, I went to Oric, and they had a meeting there on Wednesday night. They had six members. And they did not have any 12-step calling. They did not have any H&I. And I was in God's country. I could walk out from my house. There was a little hill behind me. And I could hear the waves hitting up against the beach. And I could look up at this black velvet sky and pull a star down. I could look across Redwood Creek and see these beautiful sentinels of God, the redwoods. And I was like a shriveled up walnut inside. You ever buy a beautiful walnut and open it up, and it's all shriveled up and bitter? And spiritually, that's how I was feeling. I had no 12-step calls. I had no H&I. I had nobody to give the program. And this little town of Oric was 911 people, and all of them alcoholics. But the person who had started the meeting there was the resident deputy sheriff. town was split. And anything that Jim Kennedy had something to do with, nobody else did. So if I wanted a meeting, I had to run 50-some miles up the road to Central Point, or I had to run 40-some miles down the road to McKinleyville or Eureka, or I could go farther on down and go to other meetings, but there was nothing where I lived. And it was killing me, absolutely killing me spiritually. I couldn't do anything for anybody. Because if you live that far away from the meetings, you can't get a 12-step call. Their H&I was, it is now functioning. It is now functioning. I did a lot of screaming, and it's really quite active now. But it was bad. It was bad. And I couldn't survive that way. So I moved back down. I moved to a little town named Olivehurst. I still wanted my daughter out of big cities. And this is where my daughter first ran into trouble, in this little oaky town.
Is that near Tahoe?
No.
Where's all
you know where Marysville is?
Yeah, okay, yeah.
It's right across the bridge from Marysville. So I got very ill up there. And my daughter had gone out and was running around and doing crazy things. I was running down to coroners in Marysville, Yuba City, Sacramento. I went to five of them to identify young bodies. And I was getting sicker and sicker and sicker. So I came down here where I could be near doctors that could take care of me, which was one of the, well, God, I think, did it. Because I was pretty contented where I was, except for her being out there. But I had to be near a large city because of my health. I needed, and this was the last place I thought of going. I wanted to get closer to San Francisco, but I couldn't afford it. So I came here, and then Danny and Annie and a couple of other people came to live with me. And I lived in a big four-bedroom house, and we put our money in the pot, and everything went real well, you know. But then I... Danny got married, Annie left home, John went to Berkeley, and I came here because it was, I could handle it. This, as high as this rent is, it's the cheapest there is in the area. And I certainly couldn't live in the Bay Area. But let me tell you about God. I have the most fabulous doctor. He's a little Oriental man who believes in God, who sends his patients to me here at the house. If they're drinking too much, he'll say, I'll do what I can for your heart, but I want you to go talk to this lady, or I'm not going to take care of you. And so they come down here, and I have bundles of literature here that I give to them. And we talk about AA, and then either they take me and we go to a meeting, or I call somebody who has a car that can pick them up and take them to a meeting. But my doctor works with me in AA.
Isn't that fantastic? Now I want to go back some more. I want to go back some more. When did you see Bill Wilson again the first time after you got sober?
We opened a 12-step house. A woman's recovery house on Hoover in Los Angeles, very early on. And on the front of it we put Alcoholics Anonymous, Women's Recovery House. And then we ran all over town because even my sponsor wouldn't speak to me. We wanted each group to pay $18 for a bit. And then they could always bring a woman there. And Tex said, God damn, you can't set any price on that. Either it's for alcoholics or it's not. So he wouldn't support us. He did in the end. But in the beginning, he wouldn't. So we ran to everybody, the Lions, the city, everybody, and we begged for money. And so Bill came up, and he said, "You can't do that." And I said, "I'm doing it." He said, "But you can't do it. You will take the name Alcoholics Anonymous over. You can say Alcoholic Recovery House, but you cannot say Alcoholics Anonymous and go beg for money." Well, very belligerently, I said, "Well, we're having a hard time buying wood for the fireplace, and we'll burn the damn sign and make a new one." So I wouldn't let him win. A very short while after that, Bill came out for another reason. We had an organization called Tender Loving Care, and there were a couple of real nice guys that had started it. And it was in Santa Monica.
What was it?
They called it Tender Loving Care.
A recovery house? Or uh-huh. I mean a halfway house or something?
Yeah, a halfway house.
Okay, go ahead. I didn't interrupt you.
They, two men involved in it. One of them, Bill went down and talked to and told him, "You can't have Alcoholics Anonymous there because you're collecting money." The same as he told me. This man said to him, "I don't need you, Alcoholics. None of you got any money anyway. I will deal with the narcotics." And he proceeded to deal with the narcotics. And he became a millionaire.
Charlie D.
And a few years ago, they took Chuck Dietrich off a plane, loaded to the gills. Can you imagine if Bill had permitted that? What would have happened to Alcoholics Anonymous?
You are talking about Chuck Dietrich and Synonym.
Synonym.
Yeah.
But you see, God worked. God worked. Chuck Dietrich, maybe some people got clean with Chuck. I don't know. But it became an awful ripoff. Political, almost, I guess it became a cult. When you wind up putting rattlesnakes in people's mailboxes, you know. Chuck was into some real bad stuff. But Bill, God moved on Bill, I think. And a lot of people didn't like him when he stood up and said, "You will not do that."
He was firm about that.
He was firm.
I mean, there wasn't any...
Up until that day,
you don't do it.
Up until that day in Kyle Auditorium, when he made you and you and me responsible for this program, when he let go of the helm and became a member of AA, he had to hang on tough. Bill had to make as many enemies as he made friends. He had to do it. And anyone else probably couldn't have, you know? What you have to realize is that Bill and Dr. Bob and Ebby and all the rest of them were human beings. And they weren't perfect. They were alcoholics doing the best they knew how at any given time. And maybe all of us, Bill, Dr. Bob, Ebby, Emil, myself, everybody. We've made mistakes, but we've done the best we knew how then.
Did Bill remember you?
Oh, yes. Yes.
Did he really?
Yeah, right to the very end, too.
He remembered having drank with the Metropole.
And yeah. The last time I saw Bill was in Miami when he had to go to the hospital from the conference. And I never saw him after that. For a while, I would call New York to talk to Bill before he got really sick, you know, before his... I guess we all go the same way. Our lungs and our heart. You're doing it, too.
Mm-hmm.
But... I would call him if something happened in a group, and I'd say, Bill, you know what they're doing? And he had one pat answer for me. He'd say, yeah, but if you don't like what they're doing, don't leave the group. Hang in there till you change it. If you think it's wrong, change it.
His thing was, in there, the group is autonomous, hang in there, and it's That's not right. our business back here, right?
That's right.
Well, tell me now, you told us a beautiful story about, you got a beautiful butterfly up here. Will you tell me the story?
Bill gave
about
me that butterfly.
Do you remember about when that was?
When I was about 5 years sober.
Early 50s.
We were at the club on Wilshire Boulevard. And I hadn't gotten rid of all my terrible language yet. And Bill told me about profanity and the alcoholic. He said, you know, when you come to Alcoholics Anonymous, you're in a rough, ugly cocoon. But after you've been here for a while, that cocoon opens up and you become a beautiful butterfly. And he gave me that butterfly. It's old and it's decrepit, but it's willed to this lady who was just here. It's in my will because she loves it. So she will get my butterfly. And so I love that butterfly. You see, Bill never leaves me. I have that oil painting of him over there. Mm-hmm. And even his big ears. How big his ears are?
What was the occasion when he gave you the butterfly thing?
I think it was just a meeting, and we all went to Ollie Hammond's for dinner or something.
He had been out. He was
out. He was just out here visiting.
And okay.
He did that every once in a while, you know. He might have had a pitch somewhere around the country or something, you know, and was close by and stopped in. He was like that. I remember one time at the 6300 Club. Bill was there, and, you know, they played cards upstairs. He used to go up, and there was a landing with a window at it, and then you'd turn, and you'd go up another flight of stairs into the card room. And they couldn't get anyone to go on a 12-step call. 12-step call came in. Everybody was in the midst of a game. And Bill picked up the cards and threw them out that window. He was much hated by a lot of people. Bill was not the most loved man by some of the old-timers.
Is that right?
Oh, they'll paint him now. But you see, there were some of us like Tex and myself and Emil who appreciated what Bill did. Somebody had to be firm because we were a bunch of crazies. You know? And God had cleansed Bill with his terrific spiritual experience, because God intended to use him. And that's why none of the rest of us have anything like that happen to us. Like they called it Bill's hot flash. Well, I'm glad he had it. I'm glad he had it. Because he was just a human being until God picked him up to use him.
Did you ever make it back to Stepping Stones?
Oh, yes. I have a little stone here in a jar, a little piece of rock that came from the worry room. As I came out of the worry room, I leaned down and picked it up so I'd have a little piece of it. I went back since he's been dead.
Have you, did you know Lois when
yes.
Bill was still drinking?
Mm-mm.
So you met her after you got
met
sober?
Met her afterwards, after I was sober.
Can you tell me a little bit about her, your kind of your impressions, and in what context?
Lois worshipped Bill. Bill was Lois's God. I don't know if how they did, but I know that I look at her and I always think she loved him even drunk. She always. Thank God for Lois, and thank God for Ann. You know, I've learned to love the Al-Anons who hung in there, that made my way of life possible, because if Lois hadn't hung on to him and Anne hadn't hung on to Bob, where would we be? You know, we talk about the founders, but we don't give these little ladies enough credit. We don't give them enough credit. They were beautiful people. They were beautiful people. And they walked many a mile for us. Many a mile. And we wouldn't be here if it wasn't for them, probably. And I appreciate them today.
When Dr. Bob made that, what you might call a 12-step call on you and your husband,
yeah,
in Akron in the hotel there, did you ever see him again after that?
Oh, yes. Many times.
Well, tell me about some of those.
Well, Emil would every once in a while feel like he had to go back. He used to call it the watering trough. And we'd go back. And you know, there are 12 steps on Ardmore that lead up to Bob's house. You know that, don't you?
I recall something about that. Mm-hmm. It was wasn't in a corner house.
Mm-hmm.
And
you go up those steps.
Kind of a high,
yeah,
kind of on a mound.
That's
sort
right.
of a thing.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And they have a room downstairs where they locked Ebby when he got drunk that time. And they locked other drunks down there too. Anne was like Lois, a gentle, loving person. They were the kind of women that I would like to be. They were the beautiful, feminine women. Always, always beautiful, feminine women. The kind that a person like me resents because I can't be like them. You know what I mean? I can't be like them. No matter how I try, God gave them special gifts and special talents and a great capacity for love, because they had to love their two men enough that when those two men started dragging us in on their private life, Lois went to work in a store and became practically a short order cook in her own home. Anne did the same thing in her home. The difference was that Anne had two adopted children.
Sue and...
Scotty.
Scotty?
Mm-hmm.
She had one natural child, too. She and, wasn't there, isn't there a
Not Bob, that I know of.
A Bob Smith?
I didn't think so. Maybe Scotty is Bob.
Yeah, there is a Bob Smith, and there was Sue Windows, right?
Yeah. Well, she married Windows.
She married Windows.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that's right. She'd have been Sue Smith. She was,
yeah,
adopted.
Mm-hmm.
And Dr. Bob's son is now married to an alcoholic.
Mm-hmm.
Rika Betty.
Mm-hmm.
Sir. Well, then your impressions of Bob and Bill on the main was that Dr. Bob was kind of the steady
He was the
force.
Even keel.
The even keel.
He kept,
yeah,
everything on an even keel, you know. And where Bill would rush in where angels feared to tread, Bob would not disturb.